Well, we are jumping into an hour and a half that I'm not comfortable with entirely.
Why is that, puppy?
A little vulnerability happening here. Dr. Johnson is a leading innovator in the field of couple therapy and adult attachment. Sue would be her first name, is the primary developer of emotionally focused couples and family therapy, EFT. Get a lot of sports on that channel, I think.
Yes, and you can see into the future.
Which has demonstrated its effectiveness in over 30 years of peer-reviewed clinical research. Wow! She's founding director of the International Center for Excellence in Emotionally Focused Therapy and distinguished research professor at Allegheny University in San Diego, California, as well as Professor Emeritus Clinical Psychology at the University. I don't want to read her stuff anymore. I want to talk to her. Because you could go on about her accolades for quite a long time. Here's the website, drsuejohnson.com. drsuejohnson.com. And she joins us all the way from the Prime Minister's office in Ottawa. Hello.
Hey, Drew. Nice to be with you.
Nice to be with you as well. What is the number one most irritating thing that happens during interviews with you with the media? What just drives you nuts?
I basically tell people what I think is an amazing message, which is that we finally understand so much about love and we have all this hope about helping people create it. And then the journalist basically says to me, yes, but what about all these other things like polyamory, non-monogamy? And in other words, the journalist says, but what about all these sensationalist things in the media?
Right.
Don't you think that they're really where it's at? And to tell you the truth, I just feel like saying, Are you kidding me? You know, you got to be kidding me. I mean, I'm just giving you the real goods here, and you're asking me, you know, where the, I'm giving you the caviar, and you're asking me where the chips are. That's how I feel about it.
Well said. Awesome. Like only a British lady could say. By the way, do you remember the Red Rose tea commercial?
No. What was it?
Only in Canada, eh? Pity.
Oh, right. Yes, okay. Well, hey, I feel real proud of us when I go all over the world, which I do. I feel real proud of us to say that, you know, Canadians have got this sort of kind of reputation for being kind of cool and reasonable and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So I like it when I say, hey, listen, you know, right now, Canadian researchers, we're the ones that are pushing the boundaries and helping people understand what romantics love is all about, what adult attachment is all about. We're the ones that are pushing the boundaries, talking about sexuality. We've got all these sex researchers in Canada. We're right up there in the relationship, you know, sweepstakes, it seems to me.
I concur totally. I concur totally. Happy 10th anniversary, by the way. Hold me tight.
Oh, thanks. It's so funny. That book was the first book I wrote for the public, and it was the I'm an academic, right? And it was so hard, and it sold amazingly well. But the thing that is wonderful about it is it's still selling amazingly well, and we get all these amazing messages from all over the world. This week we just got one from Iran. Yesterday morning I just got one from Uganda.
Man.
Telling us that people are doing, giving out Hold Me Tight, and translating it and doing little workshops on it, and it's making a huge difference to people's lives. So that's what it was for. It was a hell of a book to write. You know, it's something to do all kinds of studies and research. But then to write something that, you know, everyone can sit in their living room and drink their red rose tea and say, oh, yeah, oh, that's me. That's what happens in my relationship.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, gee, I never knew you could have that kind of conversation. That changes everything. That's harder. That's harder than doing a big research study.
Dr. Sue Johnson, who'd have thunk that someone raised by nuns would come out with this kind of material?
You know that. Right. Well, That's true. My headmistress basically suggested to me quite strongly that I should choose God rather than a man, mm-hmm. as she put it.
Right.
Sort of contempt in her voice. So, but those nuns were also clever ladies, and they taught their girls how to think. So maybe they'd kind of get a kick out of it, you know? Why not? I mean, the Christian Gospels talk about love all the time. They talk about how important it is. And, you know, so it, in a way, it sort of fits with what the nuns told me, that I've become obsessed with love relationships, romantic love relationships.
Well, I'm glad that you're doing this, because there are other people out there in your industry that are doing it, and it makes my head turn to one side, some of the folks that are out there. But I've come across some very interesting people that speak. Look, I'm a love junkie. Okay, I love hearing how people met. I love hearing proposal stories. I cry in sappy movies.
Yeah.
I just am a pathetic little man, basically, is what I'm saying. But that also means I read a lot. I listen to a lot. I watch a lot of videos and these people and this thing. And so I want to just do a quick little game show thing with you, and then we'll get into the good stuff, okay?
Go on, then.
I'm going to reef off a few names of people, or reel off, I guess would probably be the better way to say it. And I just want a real, like, first reaction when I say their name, okay? Really quick. These are people in the love industry, the relationship industry. Ready?
Okay, I might not know them, but go for it.
Okay, let's start with Gottman's.
Oh, he's my friend. He's got good research. People should pay attention to him. We think we're better. We have outcome research. We can prove that our interventions work. Mm-hmm. But John Gottman's a great guy. I mean, he's trying to help us understand love.
Gary Chapman, 5 Love Languages.
I think he's real well-intentioned, but he doesn't know much about love, really. There aren't 5 love languages, I'm sorry. Cutting the lawn and then trying to prove to your lady that she should feel love because of that just doesn't work.
This is not a person. This is a something that I have found quite helpful in my world over the last couple of years, the Enneagram. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I haven't ever heard of that. Sorry.
Oh, interesting. All right. Harville Hendrix, who I was introduced to through a friend of mine who's a curator with TED. What do you think about Harville Hendrix?
Well, Harville was, you know, he was cutting edge many, many years ago. I mean, he started talking, you know, to Oprah about relationship education, and that was a real good thing. Mm-hmm. But really, I think, you know, so much has happened since Harville did that, and we know so much more. Mm-hmm. And his sort of structured conversations, I think they can help couples a little bit, but I don't really think they're where it's at anymore. Okay. But he made a contribution to the field. It's just that in the last 20 years, the field has just exploded, okay? It's just gone into really rigorous research, and we've understood so much about adult attachment and bonding that it's changed, right?
Do you have an opinion on Brené Brown?
I think she's fine. She talks about vulnerability in a nice way that helps people tune into it. I don't think she particularly knows anything about what we're talking about, which is about love relationships and how to have them. She's not a researcher. Yeah. She's a TED talker, you know, and I think...
Well, she is a researcher, I think.
Sorry?
I think she is a researcher. I think that is her primary thing.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
But anyway,
all right.
Never mind.
Now, ready for this one?
I think she talks about vulnerability, and we need to have people talking about vulnerability because our culture seems to want us to think that we're all invulnerable,
so
we don't need other people.
Yeah. All right, let's finish with one more.
Mm?
Ready for this, Tim?
Yeah.
Well, I want Tim to pay attention. Ready for this?
Okay. It was
ready?
Just, yep.
Esther Perel.
Yeah.
What? Come on. Esther Perel is a beautiful woman who speaks directly into the camera. And
yes, I know, and that's all she does.
Oh.
Ooh.
Snap.
She doesn't know anything. Nearly everything she says is wrong. It's all sensationalist hype. And she doesn't know, she's never been to the library, she doesn't know, she sends people like me berserk because she says the opposite of what we know is true from all kinds of research studies in the last 20 years. And, you know, she's just a good speaker, that's all. And our society's in love with hype and sensationalism. I mean, she can, you know, she's a very good speaker. But what she says, when you really look at it, is nonsense. She basically says, for example, that secure attachment and eroticism don't go together. Well, I'd like her to show me just one research study that shows that. I'd like her to show me, because I can talk to you for 30 minutes about how that's not true. So, and from my point of view, she's disturbing, because we're knowing so much about love, and folks like her, kind of from my point of view, are taking us in the wrong direction.
Okay. How do you really feel?
Yeah, that's how I really feel, man. You asked me how I really feel. That's how I really feel.
Oh, boy, that's funny. Listen, we need to get some terms straight here for our listeners. And
go on, then.
I'm going to pretend it's our listeners that don't know what they're talking about. Attachment theory. How do you concisely explain that to the person sitting beside you on the plane?
Okay. So attachment basically started out years ago with an English psychiatrist who started looking at the relationship between mother and child, which in those days was kind of like, you know, people said, oh, kids love their mothers because their mothers feed them. I mean, that's how basic it was, okay? Or mothers are actually, they're danger. Mother love is dangerous. You've got to teach kids how to be independent. I mean, this is kind of what we were listening to. And this man said, no, no. You know, if you look at the interaction between mother and child, there's something magical going on here. You know, there's something basic to survival. This is not just sentimental or you know, this is somehow when the child feels connected with the mother, the child's nervous system calms down, the child feels safe, the child opens up to listening to the mother, opens up to experience, the child feels stronger and able to explore. And he just looked at all these interactions between mothers and children, and basically, when he did that, he really outlined what that relationship was all about, how powerful it was, and his view has changed our image of parenting in the last 50 years. It's changed how we see our kids. It's changed how we treat our kids. It's changed how we understand the needs of children. So, you know, it's really about understanding that we're not human beings are bonding social animals who need safe connection with other people. A safe connection is basically where you know that you're important enough to me, that if you're vulnerable and you call me, you call for me, you know I will come. And that gives you a sort of emotional balance. It gives you a way to face life. It gives you a sense of security. And that sense of security impacts everything in your life, from how you see yourself, for how lovable you think you are, for how safe you think other people are, from your mental health, from how resilient you are. So this is a powerful theory that's kind of taken over psychology. I mean, it's one of the really hot things in psychology in the last 50 years, but it's only been applied to adults in about the last 15. And because the theory was that adults didn't need this kind of connection. You know, adults were kind of self-sufficient. The only self-sufficient human being is a dead human being, okay? So let's get clear about that. We're not wired that way. We're wired to communicate and connect with other people and to face life with other people. If you like, if you want an image, basically attachment believes what Mozart believed. Mozart said, love guards the heart from the abyss. And by the way, that's what a lot of religious truths say too. If you look in the great religious texts of the world, they say the same thing. You know, it's like the security we have in life, the ground we stand on in life, just like, and you know this in your bones, the way you know to take your next breath. The ground we stand on is our connection with these special people in our life, and we bring them into our mind. you know, when you're an adult, you don't need to touch your partner all the time or touch someone who, your parents, or you have them in your mind. You know, you talk when you get upset. You might talk to your wife. You hear her in your head telling you, it's okay. When you get home, we'll talk about it. It'll be fine. So we're starting to understand that love is this amazing resource that we need to survive and to thrive. And the basis of all that is attachment theory. So this is kind of a huge theory. I'm giving it to you in like 3 yeah. minutes. I don't know.
Yeah, but that's what you got to do in media. You know that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay.
That's basically it. And it's revolutionizing all kinds of things in psychology. You know, it's pretty practical in it's not just like a theory, like, you know, you leave it on the shelf. It's really got a lot of implications, you know, like I give you a real implication you'd never imagine from a theory of love and connection. The Israeli army have looked at the way their leaders give emotional support to young recruits, and they found out that leaders who have what they call a secure style, who support their young recruits emotionally, who listen to them, who confide in them, who teach them to trust each other and turn to each other, their recruits are better soldiers. They deal with the tasks of war better. They support each other more. They don't have so many breakdowns. It's kind of interesting. It's sort of we're really, you know, it's really telling us that our biggest resource as human beings is other people, is the other people that we trust in the world.
Okay, Dr. Sue Johnson.
Yes.
Pretend that I'm a hockey player who's been hit in the head one too many times with a hockey puck. Because we're not far off, really.
All right.
And
I tell him?
Yeah, well, I want to know, if I had known this attachment theory stuff,
yeah,
what impact could that have possibly made on my 29-year marriage ending last year?
Oh, it could have made a big difference.
Oh, thanks.
Okay, if you'd come to us and we'd helped you understand love from an attachment point of view and the way you interact, we could have helped you understand the way you and your wife trigger each other. We could have helped you understand the basic fears that you get into that a happy couple help each other with. Everybody's terrified of rejection and abandonment. Everybody. It just goes with being human. We'd have helped you understand your basic needs. We'd have helped you understand how to talk about those needs in a way that helped the other person respond to you. What the research says is the best predictor of whether your marriage is going to make it or not is how emotionally responsive you can be to each other. Everyone fights. Everyone gets stuck in fights, okay? The point is the happy couples can find a way to turn back towards each other and reach for each other in a way that helps the other person feel safe and connected. They can respond to each other. And we teach people how to have these hold-me-tight conversations. We have an educational program now on hold-me-tight conversations that's given all over the world, okay, for couples. Even doctors are starting to use it in hospitals for people like cardiac patients with their wives and their partners. So, you know, this is supremely practical. It would basically teach you how you and your partner are freaking each other out and triggering each other and scaring each other and how you can create this safety in your relationship and answer each other's needs in a way that creates this loving feeling. And that's pretty revolutionary.
Okay.
You know,
okay. Hold on, though. But at the beginning of every marriage, you do all that stuff, and then you don't.
In the beginning of every marriage, you do some of it, but then what happens is people start to disagree, they start to hurt each other, they start to, you know, love is a dance. You're going to step on each other's feet. You're going to turn in the wrong direction. You're going to upset each other. So then those things start to happen, and the couple don't know what's going on. They're caught in this dreadful drama. Usually what we see is distress turns out to be one person's pushing to be listened to be seen, to be responded to.
Yes.
And that sounds like criticism.
Yes.
And the other person's protecting themselves by turning away, withdrawing, saying, I don't want to talk about this. And the more the person...
I'm sorry, hold on. Were you living in my house?
Yes. I've seen so many... I've seen thousands of couples, man. There's some ways where I'm living in everybody's house. These patterns... This is part of the science of love. It's a relief to know, you know, relationships are not unique. We all get stuck in the same patterns. We all have the same needs. We all get caught in cycles of criticism and withdrawal. What we don't understand is we don't understand the impact we have on each other. For example, most guys don't understand that when they shut down and say, I don't want to talk about this, because they just think it's going to get worse, I'm going to feel even more rejected, I'm going to hear that I'm a big disappointment. When they shut down, they're just trying to protect themselves and stop the fight, which is makes so much sense. But they don't get that they're shutting their partner out. And when they shut their partner out and their partner feels emotionally alone and not connected, that freaks their partner out, and their partner gets more upset, more angry, more hurt. And couples get caught in this dance, and they don't even see it. So we help them see it, and then we help them create a positive conversation where they can reach for each other and share, help each other with their fears, share their needs. And it's pretty magical. I mean, our research studies say that when you have these hold-me-tight conversations in our educational programs, in our therapy, when you have them, it predicts that your relationship is healed, it's no longer distressed at the end of therapy, and it predicts success in our educational groups, and it predicts follow-up. We're the only approach to couples therapy on this planet right now that can show you that when we help couples create these changes, 2-3 years down the pike, those changes are still solid. They're still there. Because they're still having hold-me-tight conversations.
On the line with Dr. Sue Johnson, of course, you might remember her from such books as Love Sense and Hold Me Tight. We've got to talk about EFT because we're dropping that code, you know, like everyone
should know what
it is. But emotionally focused couple therapy, EFT. Yeah. Sounds hocus pocus.
Yeah, it does a bit. But, you know, we had to call it that because at the time it was put together, you know, really everybody in the field of couples therapy was doing everything but talking about emotion. It was like emotion was like the, whoa, don't go there, don't touch that. You know, that's going to just make everything worse. And so we were trying to make a statement. We were trying to say, no, no, no. A relationship is a dance. Emotion is the music of the dance. You gotta work with the music. You gotta change the music if you want to change the dance. You could do all kinds of other stuff to change the dance, but you're not going to teach people to do a waltz, no matter how positive it is.
Oh, hold on, I got to recap something.
Tango music.
I've got to recap what you've just said here. I got to get this down. This is like my little Oprah aha moment here.
All right.
So love is a dance.
Yep. And emotion is the music. And so the...
And you've got to change the music, not the dance.
You've got to change the music to change the dance. If most couples therapists, they try to change the music by giving people new ideas or new skills or making new deals. The point is, the most powerful thing in the room is the music. If you don't change the emotional music, everything else is... you know, peripheral. I mean, it doesn't really have much impact.
Okay, hold on. But if you're married to someone, and by the way, let me just get, it's time to get personal. I said I had a goal. Well, I had a goal of not talking about me until we reached the halfway mark of our interview.
Go on then.
So, first of all, I asked, I guess I have to say my ex. I'm still getting used to the terminology. I asked my ex if it was okay to talk about this on air.
Okay.
And she said yes.
Okay.
Okay, so I want to make that clear. Number two, I'm the chick in the relationship.
You're the chicken?
I probably shouldn't use that term.
Woman?
I'm the woman. I'm the
female?
I'm the one. You know, we kind of have these stereotypical views of the man shutting down and having no emotions.
Right. You were the one that was wanting to talk and have connection.
Yes.
And
my wife was, I talked about the Enneagram earlier. She has real problems just kind of getting below the surface and talking about. She's so busy doing that she has a hard time being a human being. You know what I mean?
Yeah. She has a hard time just letting herself feel and going into that emotional channel.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's kind of where we're at with all this.
Yeah. And so then that leaves you alone there.
It does leave me alone there. So my question is, how do you get somebody who doesn't give a holy grunt about the emotional side of things, or has the, not that's unfair. She gives. Oh, sorry, I gotta personalize it, but not personalize it. How do you get somebody who is disconnected with their emotional awareness to become emotionally aware? It seems like that is the biggest uphill battle in the world.
No, it's not at all.
Oh, okay.
We're real good at it. You know, we work with people who absolutely would rather die than go into their emotions. We work with Navy SEALs. We work with the firemen of New York. We work with the policemen of Denver, guys who believe that if I let myself feel, I won't be a good man anymore. I won't be able to do my job. I'll be a wimp. And we work with them just fine. I think a lot of it is, we create an atmosphere way before you start working actively. We know how to create safety in our educational groups and in our sessions. We know how to create safety. And so we, first of all, get people to realize we're not blaming anybody. We're not trying to find out who the bad guy is. We know how to help people with their relationships. And so people start to relax with us. They don't feel in danger, they don't feel threatened. We start by just saying to somebody who's used to shutting down, we don't say, oh, you've got to change. That doesn't work.
Really?
Right? We say to people, you must have very, very good reasons for shutting down those emotions so fast and staying away from them and avoiding them. You must have very good reasons. So let's look at the reasons that you have for doing that. What is it that's, what's going to happen if you let yourself feel? I had one guy who said to me once, he was a Navy SEAL. He said, I don't know what you're talking about, emotion. All I feel, the only emotion I have is anger, right? And so the thing is, you are in a situation where they're there with their partner, and usually there's a threat in the room, you know, like they're going to lose this relationship. Right? And so there's a vulnerability up and running in the room. So all you have to do is gradually help ease them into it. So you say to this man, could you help me? All you're aware of is anger. So what happens to you? And then I trigger him into his softer vulnerability. What happens to you when your wife turns, like she did right now, and says, I'm so alone in this relationship, I'm going to leave you. I'm going to leave you. I'm going to give up and walk out. What happens to you? The first thing the guy says is nothing. Well, the point is, you know, if you're a therapist who doesn't work the way we do, you might actually believe
him. No
exactly.
One's going to believe
so
nothing.
Say,
come on.
I say, no, I'm sorry, but that's impossible. You're a human being.
Yeah.
You're a bonding mammal. Let's go back there. What happens to you when and I trigger him again, I give him the message again, but I do it in a soft, slow voice. I help soothe him at the same time, and he says, there's no point in talking about it. There's nothing I can do. I say, oh, I understand. So what happens to you when you hear this is you go right into this sense of helplessness. There's no point in letting yourself listen to this because there's nothing you can do. Now, already he's opening up to me. All you have to do is stay there and help people talk about it. You also talk about what's happening in his body. I say, what happens to you, what's happening to you right now? And he says, I don't want to talk about this because I can't breathe. I say, I understand that there's something here. You say all you feel is anger, but when your wife turns and says this to you, this feeling that there's no point, this sense of helplessness comes up, and you feel what? You can't breathe in your chest. And what do you say to yourself? He says, what I say to myself is, it's a waste of time. There's something wrong with me. Did I ever think anyone was going to love me? Right. And I say, and how are you feeling right now? And he says, I don't know. And I say, you have tears on your cheek. And he brushes them away and he says, yes, I have tears on my cheek. But all I feel is anger. I say, yes, okay. You're used to talking about anger. You can somehow have some comfort with anger. When you have tears on your cheek in this situation, it's so hard for you. You don't know what words to use. Or so what I see in your face is sadness, but that may not fit for you. You don't know what words to use. So in other words, we're very, very good at holding people's hand and slowly walking them into this territory called their emotions. We know the territory. We know what's there. We know how to help them make sense of it. And then people come. You know, they feel safe. Mm. So after 30 minutes, this guy can turn to his wife and say, I do shut down, because the minute I see that look on your face, even before you tell me you're going to leave or I'm just overwhelmed, it's hopeless, I just want to run, I just want to get away, and I don't know what to do with all these soft things, I don't know what to do with it. So listen to what he says after half an hour. I mean, so it's actually not hard. In fact, it's very hard to suppress our emotions.
So this is a summary of emotionally focused couple therapy. That's what you just laid on us, right?
That's part of it, yeah. That's not all of it, but that's a part of it, is getting people who withdraw to come out onto the dance floor and start to dance in a different way.
So what I heard in all of this is, and I just, you know, at the risk of sounding a tad narcissistic, let me inject myself into this story a little more. I over the last couple of years, like a year and a half ago, whatever, I decided to walk the Camino. And I did it, I walked 1,000 kilometers within a three-month vow of silence, because if anybody needed to shut up, it's me.
Good for you.
And I came out of it with a greater awareness of a number of things. One of them is something that the Kripalu yoga world teaches, which is non-judgmental, compassionate self-awareness. So yes. When I became aware of things, I would beat myself instead of being non-judgmental and compassionate. But also, I realized that I had these numerous fractured relationships, and I was the common denominator.
Yes.
So I needed to look at that and go, all right, first of all, I now had a greater respect and appreciation for who I was at this point in my life.
Yes.
And I actually began to believe that I had something to offer my spouse.
Yes.
As opposed to what I would normally do is just go, well, you don't want to talk and you can't, you know, you don't have any feelings. You're feeling, right? I just start firing off all my weapons kind of thing.
Yeah.
Instead of seeing myself in a way that I actually know stuff, and then saying to my ex, say, okay, I could walk her through it with what I knew. And yes. I could actually dial it down, because it wasn't about friggin' me.
Yes.
And I could help her walk into some emotionally focused couple therapy.
Yes.
But the objectivity wasn't there. So that's why people are leaning into you guys, because the outsiders can help the befuddled couple.
That's right. I mean, and to be honest, I mean, when what we understand about love relationships is so much is at stake. You know, it's like love is not a mixture of sentimentality and sexuality. It's an ancient wired-in survival code designed to keep people you can depend on close to you. So much is at stake when things start to go wrong in a relationship. Everybody's terrified of rejection and abandonment. Everybody, mm-hmm. Your nervous system is wired to see that as dangerous. It puts you at risk. To be alone is to be at risk in the natural world.
Okay, so
you know, it's people get overwhelmed. They get threatened and scared and overwhelmed, And then they go to the one way they've learned. And, you know, that Navy SEAL said to me, the one way I learned with everything but anger was to just shut it down.
Yeah.
I shut it down so fast I don't even see it. Because if I hadn't done that in the neighborhood when I grew up, I'd have died.
Well, see, that's interesting. So the Navy SEAL and my ex are very comparable. Because she learned to just shut it down and stuff it. Because if she let it out back in our early days of marriage, I was even way worse of a meathead than I am now. and her world would have imploded. I was so emotionally insecure and unstable that she had to be the cruise control.
Ah, okay.
So she just shut it down, shut it down, shut it down, shut it down. It was safer. Plus, she grew up in a family where kids were not only to not, they weren't to be heard, they weren't even to be seen.
That's right. Kids were supposed to be seen and not heard.
Yeah.
And that is a very powerful image, because just think of how things have changed. And what people don't realize is that a lot of what's changed is that John Bowlby and all his attachment theory, that changed the way people understood the relationship between mother and child, that children need to be seen and need to be heard and need to be held, and so do adults. It goes from the cradle to the grave.
Right, and in her scenario, my ex's scenario, she disappeared into the wall.
Yep.
And I went the other way. I spent the rest of my life playing the role of victim.
Right.
Poor me.
And the louder you yelled, the more she just disappeared into the wall.
Yes.
And the more she disappeared into the wall, the louder you yelled.
Yep. Boy, did that work well.
Yeah, well, we get stuck there, okay? We get stuck there with the kids. We get stuck there with our partners. And the tricky part is, you're right, we do lose our objectivity. And someone like me, someone like a trained EFT therapist, and by the way, there's trained EFT therapists all over Ontario and all over Canada.
Hold on, I went to your website to see, seminars coming up or whatever the link is, and I had to scroll down about 93 pages. I can't believe, and they're in every small town around the GTA.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're
well, not just the GTA, around the world.
We're all over the world.
Yeah.
We just did the first set of things last week in Iran. There's this hunger in our impersonal world where people are lonelier and lonelier, and where the only thing the media are interested in is sensationalism and sexuality. There's this hunger for connection and to understand close relationships. And, you know, this is what drives me insane with some of these other folks that you mentioned. We do understand it. And what do we do when we finally have a science and a way of understanding love and a way of making it work? We get all distracted with all this other stuff, you know, with all kinds of theories about how polyamory is the latest way to go, or how, you know, nobody can have erotic excitement in a long-term relationship, which is baloney, okay? So we get all distracted instead of understanding, hey, wait a minute, we found the Holy Grail here. We finally understand love, what it's all about, and what goes wrong. Not only that, but this theory doesn't just tell us what goes wrong, it tells us what you got to do. We got to learn to be more emotionally responsive to each other. That's the essence of a secure bond, whether it's mother and child, sibling and sibling, you know, whether it's your partner or not, we got to learn to do that. And when we do it, everything changes.
Mm-hmm.
So there.
Yeah, seriously. I'm not supposed to have those kind of verbal gaps, but I'm actually listening instead of just, you know, pretending I'm listening to the guest. You are hold on a second. You are a very fascinating person. You are a credentialed academic. You are a prolific author. Great quote-unquote success, yada, yada, yada. But what's wrong with you?
What's wrong with me?
Yeah.
Oh, well, it depends on when you talk to me. I mean,
from a relationship point of view. I mean, if I talk to your... I don't know anything about your personal life. Do you have a husband?
Of course, for 30 years.
Okay, how would your husband throw you under the bus? If your husband and I were at the pub and we're having a few pints, And I said,
my husband would throw me under the bus by turning, by doing just what your lady did to you. I would be upset about something, and my husband, bless his heart, would throw me under the bus by turning and saying, I'm really tired now, and I think that we should talk about, we should find another time to talk about this. And what I hear is, we're not going to talk about this because I don't want to.
Right.
And then I end up not feeling listened to and not feeling important and getting more and more upset and saying, no, I want you, you've got to listen to me now. I need you to talk to me. And then he says, I'm too tired.
Yep.
And he turns away. Right? And in the beginning of our relationship, we used to have like, just fireworks all over the place.
Big battles. Yeah.
Yeah, but then, bless his heart, he would turn around, he would do a big sigh, and he would turn around and turn around and turn the light on so there's more light in the room. I thought that was always very symbolic, right? He'd turn the big light on, and he'd say, okay, this isn't working, so obviously you need to talk about this, and I don't want to, but I'm going to make myself a cup of coffee, and then we're going to sit here and I'm going to talk.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so he used to do that. But, you know, we still get stuck there sometimes. I think the difference is, though, I'm much more secure than I was at the beginning of our relationship.
Yeah.
So sometimes now I can actually say to myself, wait a minute, why are you getting so uptight?
Yep.
This is John. This is a guy who loves you. You know that.
Yep.
So just calm down and say to him, well, you know what? This is important to me. So if I'm going to let you sleep, I need to know that you are going to bring it up tomorrow and that you're willing to help me with this because I have these difficult feelings. And then he'll say, yeah, okay, I'll do that. And he does it. But only sometimes I can do that. I still get stuck sometimes. The point is, when you dance with somebody, you're going to miss cues, you're going to be in different places, you're going to step on each other's feet. The important thing in the end is to be able to look at the dance, not decide the other person is really trying to do you in, be able to understand what's happening and what you need, and turn back again and reach again for each other and find a way to connect. And if you could do that, that changes everything in a relationship.
Hugely.
It changes everything between parents and children, by the way. We work with families. It changes everything between adolescents and their fathers, male and sons and their fathers. It changes everything between mothers and daughters, right?
On the line with Dr. Sue Johnson. The website is drsuejohnson.com, drsuejohnson.com. By the way, I have a cottage beside Sue Johansson.
Oh, yes. She's a wonderful lady.
Yes.
I used to love her, listening to her talk about sex. She was so down to earth. Sometimes people think I'm her, and occasionally they send me emails full of all kinds of sexual details.
Well, we're not talking about that today.
And then I have to turn and tell them, I'm so sorry, you had the wrong
Dr.
The right
Sue.
Sue.
Yeah. Well, I told people that you were coming on the show, and many of them said, that lady? And I went, no, that lady. And they went, oh, that's nice.
Well, we still talk about sex, actually. I just come back from a big sex conference in Athens. And, of course, if you understand romantic love, you also start to understand a lot about sexuality, you know.
I wonder, this is kind of not where I was going to go with this line of questioning, but since you brought it up, do you think there's a correlation between faith communities and sex issues in relationships?
And sorry, I didn't hear you. And what?
And sex issues in relations, sexual hang-ups and, you know, that kind of thing. Is that still a thing, do you think, these days?
I don't know. To be honest with you, I think we all have sexual issues in our society. I don't know if that's really more true in faith communities.
Right.
I think perhaps in some faith communities, what might be true is that, the nuns, for example, I was brought up by the Catholic nuns. And, I think it's fair to say that their attitude to sexuality was pretty repressive. It was, you know, it was all about sin and, you know. So I think in some faith communities, people don't trust their sexuality. They don't know how to talk about it at all. It's kind of a forbidden topic. And that's like everything else that's a forbidden topic in your relationship. It can end up being quite disastrous because then you can't communicate, you can't share, you can't help each other with any issues that come up. So, you know, you can't even communicate enough to dance well together in bed or out of bed. So that can be an issue. But in general, to tell you the truth, I think we see so many couples with sexual issues that when we help them create emotional safety and a sense of being able to count on each other, when they can talk in a particular way and respond to each other emotionally, they can talk about their sexuality differently, and those lots of those sexual issues just dissolve because, you know, I give you a good example. You know, like, for example, you can get a man who is scared that he's going to come too soon, right, and he's not going to please his partner, and, you know, he's ashamed and he can't talk about it. Well, when him and his partner start talking about it, you know, everything changes. For example, he finds out that the most important thing for her is the way he talks to her when he invites her to come to bed with him. The most important thing for her is that he holds her after they've made love. And that she's not all hung up on him being something from the movies and, you know, doing this sort of dance that they've seen in the movies that we think is what
real
sex is all about.
Yeah, no.
Sex can be any way a couple want it, but they have to be able to communicate and get onto the same page. So again, it's all about safe emotional communication. It ends up being all about that.
When we say goodbye to you shortly here,
We
are going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and open up the phone lines. And contrary to what one of my interns thinks, we rarely open up the phone lines. That was an inside joke here. We rarely open up the phone lines and get into subjects and topics these days. I just find more interest speaking with guests and getting some information from the professionals and that sort of thing. But this is sort of a bleeding heart club coming up here soon. And I'm going to ask our listeners to join me in admitting what role they played in the end of their relationship.
Oh, okay.
Because there seems to be this epidemic of blame shift out there.
Yep. Well, you know, our eyeballs face out. When we don't understand what's happening to us, the easiest thing to do is look out and blame the person standing in front of you.
Yes.
Because you really don't understand how you created the dance.
Exactly. Exactly. And one thing that I have really realized, Sue, and the main roles that I played in the end of my marriage was that I was too insecure, and I spent more time walking around trying to take care of my needs and made sure I didn't care what role people played in my life as long as I got to play the role of victim. There was a whole lot of poor me going on. And it was so easy to do that because it's about communication and authenticity, and I want to be authentic, and I want to communicate, and I want to get, and we have to talk about this tonight. You know what I'm talking about, Dr. Sue Johnson?
Yes.
We have to talk about this tonight. You know, we have to communicate. And boy, and if you didn't want to do that, well, you were just wrong. You're just wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, that didn't work.
Right. Well, and you know, I think one of the things that we don't understand there is that when we push our partner in that kind of level, when we push our partner, they end up feeling criticized and blamed, and they also end up hearing that they're somehow not who we want them to be. They're disappointing us.
Yes.
So then they have their own insecurities come up, and they try to shut everything down, right? So it's like we keep it's not how we come into relationships. You know, lots of us come in feeling very insecure. It's the fact that we get stuck in a dance that keeps that insecurity going. We trigger it all the time in each other, so we never get the chance to move into a safer place.
Well, again, just letting our listeners know that in, I don't know, just after the top of the hour, we're going to open up the phone lines. The number is 877-569-1250, 877-569-1250. It's toll-free across North America, 877-JOY-1250. Look at the numbers. I mean, the letters on your phone. And I don't know. I think it's really important. I would love to actually start a movement where we kind of raise the own it awareness. Own the role that you have played in the breakdown of relationships in your world.
Yep.
I think it would be a huge help in all sorts of relationships, international relationships, political relationships. You know, you talk about the Middle East, you talk about things going in Iran.
Yeah.
Just in our own lives with our parents, kids. Well, yeah, Tim and I look.
So many of us don't even see. Don't even see the dance that we do with our partner. We just see kind of what, to change the metaphor, we see the ball coming across the net towards us and we figure out how to play it back. We don't see the game at all. We don't see the dance.
Yeah.
And so we don't even get that we're really impacting our partner. We don't even get that we're, you know, people say, this is just the way he is or she is. This is just the way, you know, my partner is completely unempathic, rude, self-centered, unaware. Well, this is the guy who I saw interacting with my secretary in my institute, and he knew that she'd been ill, and he was asking her how she was.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, when he feels safe, he can come up with empathy.
Yeah.
But his wife doesn't see that, right? And so she doesn't even understand that something's happening in the dance with her that shuts down his empathy. He doesn't understand that either. To tell you the truth, when you look at this huge drama going on and how stuck people can get and how they don't see it at all, it's amazing to me that so many of us hang in and somehow wade through all this stuff and do stay together and find a way to be together. It's not amazing that some of us divorce. It's amazing that having not understood love and what happens in love relationships at all, so many of us hang in.
I have someone who sent a question or two. May I ask you some questions on behalf of somebody who knows a little bit about this world that you live in?
Of course you can.
Questions for Dr. Sue Johnson. First and foremost, obviously, after one has decided that they have an insecure attachment style, going to need you to explain that.
Yes.
How can they become more secure? What is the specific advice for each type, or is there?
An insecure attachment style is that, you know, when you look at how people get stuck in patterns of dealing with their emotions or communicating with other people, you know, you can have a secure pattern where you feel safe enough to turn and talk about your emotions and ask for what you need. You have that sort of trust in other people, and that's secure. Or you can be anxious where you're always worried that other people are going to let you down. You're always trying to get them to prove they love you, and that's an anxious style, and it has you sort of pushing and asking questions and never sure that you're loved. And even when you're told you're loved, you don't really believe it. That's an anxious style.
I call that having a cracked love tank.
Okay, that'll do. That's a good image, actually. And the other one is avoidant, where other people have been so dangerous for you in your life that you shut down all your emotions and needs. And when you or your partner are vulnerable, you run. You say, I don't want to talk about this, and you focus on tasks, and you focus on outside things, and you shut down all your emotions. The trouble with that one is you're then emotionally unavailable to your partner, and your partner's lonely as hell. So the person said, if you're insecure, what do you do? Well, our latest research study, we got about 5 studies out of it, actually, but it's published out there in the literature, finds that people can change their styles by engaging in these new hold-me-tight conversations. You know, an anxious person, we help the anxious person own that anxiety. We help the anxious person turn and say, okay, you know, I am anxious all the time. I'm always waiting for the message from you that that I'm not quite the partner you want. This guy says to me, I'm the big disappointment. I was the big disappointment in my family, and I'm just waiting to hear that from you. So if you tell me any little thing that upsets you, it's like the whole world has started on fire. Hmm. I can hardly breathe. I'm so anxious. So I'm so scared that I'm just going to hear from you that you're going to reject me. I'm not good enough. I never feel good enough. When he's able to actually say that, and we help him put that together clearly, because it's got to be clear. When he's actually able to say that to his partner, 9 times out of 10, it elicits compassion and caring from that partner. And that partner says, I never knew that. Mm-hmm. I never knew that you felt that way. I just felt like you'd run away from me because you didn't give a damn, or that you'd attack me because you didn't give a damn. So we can work with these styles, these ways of being with other people in the dance, and we can help them talk about them, own them, help their partner respond to them in a way that helps them with those styles, and gradually move into a more secure way of being with someone.
Okay, here's another question. If mostly securely attached people have already found their partners and are presumably in stable marriages or partnerships.
That may not be true.
No, but okay, but
all right, keep going.
Yeah,
keep going.
So they're you know, you get all these mostly securely attached people and they found partners and they're in their stable marriages or partnership, whatever. What's the rest of the world supposed to do?
Get together and help each other be more secure.
Right.
We see people in second marriages all the time. And their wounds from their first marriages make them more wary or, you know, inhibit them from dancing with each other. But the bottom line is they're in our office. They come in. They know they need some help. They go get my book, Hold Me Tight. They talk to each other. They watch my videos on my YouTube. They come in for some help. They find a Hold Me Tight group, you know. It's not like all you have to do is have a secure style and you have it for the rest of your life and it ensures a loving relationship. That's not what happens. You know, I just worked with a lady who, if you listen to her, she's a pretty secure person. She had great parents. She had great relationships. She had a great first love relationship. And then she married a guy. And for the first 2 years of their marriage, everything was fine. And then for all kinds of reasons, he started drinking. And then for all kinds of reasons, his drinking got much worse and he got abusive. And the relationship turned into a massively abusive relationship. And when I saw her, you know, like 4 years later, her whole sense of self had been eroded in that relationship. She was massively insecure. She was actually believing him when he said, you're the problem here. I wouldn't drink if it wasn't for you, right? And so her security had been eroded. So security isn't something that you have and that protects you for everything. Mm-hmm. It's like a raincoat in the rain. It's like a shield. It's something you need, but it's not an absolute, and it's not something that protects you from every eventuality. Right. So, you know, the bottom line is, people, if we know what's going on in our emotional lives, if we can see it and acknowledge it, and a safe therapist helps with that a lot, mm-hmm. right? If we know what's going on, then we can own it and look at it, and we can talk about it with a partner. That's half the way home.
Oh, yeah.
More than half the way home.
Yeah.
You know, then something changes totally. And people in our Hold Me Tight weekends talk about the fact that they can go and do a Hold Me Tight weekend. You know, there's a whole bunch of them happening in Toronto, and I get emails from those folks, and they tell me, I can't believe it. I thought I was close to my partner, but now I realize there's a whole nother level. Or, I can't believe it. We couldn't even talk before we went into this group. Now we're having these amazing, trusting conversations. Oftentimes we just need some safety and some direction about what is possible and how to do it.
My cohort here in the studio, engineer slash co-host, has a t-shirt on that says, "My wife says I only have two faults. I don't listen and something else." But he actually has a great question to ask you. I normally don't let him talk. So this is quite a thing.
Yeah, so this is a breakthrough for Drew and I.
All right, then.
Go for it.
Yeah, Dr. Sue, I don't know if this is a chicken-egg situation. What role does mental health play in this? And I'm not talking like feeling stressed. I'm not belittling that. But I'm talking like clinical mental health, depression, bipolar.
Yeah.
Does that play a role in this? Does it throw everything? Is it a wrench in the works? What?
Not necessarily. We work with a lot of depressed and anxious folks. We work with a lot of military couples all over the world, not just in Canada, and what we find is that when you're having a mental health problem, often, you know, your emotional needs, you express your emotions, you either numb out or they become very extreme. And if your partner can't deal with that, your relationship gets more distressed. When your relationship gets more distressed, your mental health problem gets worse. You feel more alone, you feel more unsupported, you feel more unsure of yourself, you feel more overwhelmed. So couples get caught in this dreadful cycle where, you know, I'm depressed, and then it happens a lot with military. You know, I'm starting to have nightmares at night, I'm starting to have PTSD coming up, and I don't tell my wife. All she sees is I'm irritable and angry, and I start blowing up at her, and she withdraws from me. And the more she withdraws, the more alone I feel with the demons that are coming for me, the worse I get. The worse I get, the more she withdraws. And then she says she's going to leave me. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of the military in Canada about the fact if you really want to stop military suicides, then work with the soldiers and their partners. You know, it's as simple as that, okay? Because lots of times when somebody's committed suicide, it's in the week after their relationship has disintegrated. One of the military told me 70% of the military suicides happen when the partner has finally said, "I can't do this anymore," and left.
Oof.
So mental health and attachment security, secure connection to other people kind of go hand in hand. The more securely attached you are, the more you can confide in someone and get their help and their comfort, the more mentally healthy you're likely to be. The more mentally healthy you are, the more you can listen to your partner and give them empathy. And so it goes hand in hand. But the promising thing here is that the way we do couples therapy, and our research supports this, is that when you create this secure bond between partners, the partner then comes in and helps you with your depression, comes in and helps you with your anxiety. You get better. The relationship gets better. Your partner understands what's happening for you. You don't feel so alone. I mean, you can see it as a kind of cascade. So mental health and secure connections with other people go together. They really do go together. And that's an interesting one, because our society is in love with, if somebody's got a mental health problem, you just give them a pill. Just give them a pill, and if they don't respond, they're on the wrong pill. And you don't say, wait a minute, who do you trust in your life? Can you turn and confide in when the world gets overwhelming? You know, who do you trust with the part of you that you're scared isn't okay? Who do you go to for reassurance? We don't ask those kinds of questions. Your doctors are overwhelmed. And they just say, if you're having some depression, you know, here, just take this pill. So oftentimes it doesn't work. It just addresses the symptom. The number of military folks I've had say to me, all these pills do is numb me out. All these pills do is numb me out, and I'm numbed out to the point where I don't know which way is up anymore. And, you know, we need to look at creating secure relationships and more connection between people as a mental health intervention. We need to do that. And, you know, physical doctors are ahead of the game. You know, we do work with the Heart Institute here in Ottawa. They asked us to come in and create a program for their partners, for heart patients and their partners, and we did that. We used the Hold Me Tight book, and it's called Healing Hearts Together, and it's amazingly popular, and we've got a big grant to do research on it now. And, you know, if you listen to these people, the spouse says, I was starting to get depressed because he came home from the hospital and I had all these instructions about his meds and what to be watch for, and I was starting to get depressed and overwhelmed, and then I couldn't even talk to him, and this has helped me so much. And the heart patient says, I feel so much better now, I can turn and talk to her and tell her how scared I am of another heart attack, and, you know, I can go to her for comfort and caring, and she reminds me about my medical appointments, she reminds me to take my pills. And I don't hear it as criticism. I know she's scared of losing me and doesn't want me to have another attack. You can see how this safe connection translates into better mental and physical health. It's not rocket science.
No.
You can see it in the session. It makes total sense.
Well, is it any wonder that this woman is taking over the world, ladies and gentlemen? DrSueJohnson.com is the website. And, of course, her books, Love Sense, Hold Me Tight. By the way, we'll finish with this. I think I said that already, but let's really finish with this. Rumor has it. That you did one of these books with somebody with some kind of a God connection, and now there's some, like, is there God?
Oh, I'm very proud of it. We took Hold Me Tight, and we have adapted it with my wonderful colleague from Nashville in the States called Kenny Sandifer. We took Hold Me Tight and we have adapted it for Christian communities, and it's called Created for Connection. Huh. So it's Hold Me Tight but adapted for Christian couples, and we're very proud of it. It's what amazed me when Kenny came and suggested it to me. I started to go back and look at in the religious literature, in the literature on bonding and religion, on people's sense of attachment to God. There's literature on that's fascinating. I went back and looked at the Gospels, and I was blown away. I mean, the truth, the essential truth, as I understand it, the essential truth of the Gospels and the essential truth in attachment fit together perfectly. You know, attachment says that the factors that create a secure bond are for people to be open and accessible to each other, emotionally responsive and engaged. A-R-E. The answer to the question, are you there for me, is the multi-million-dollar question in love relationships. Are you there for me? A-R-E. Well, if you look at the stories of Christ, he is the absolute epitome of A-R-E. He's accessible, responsive and engaged. Nobody comes to him, and, you know, the woman who touches his garment, the woman who's not supposed to talk to him because she's got an issue of blood, the woman who puts her tears on his feet. People are always trying to keep people away from him. And what does he do? He turns, he connects with them, he's open, he's accessible, he responds to them very personally. He says to them, you know, you are with me. You matter to me. Mm-hmm. I'm with you. So this is fascinating. So, yes, we're very proud of it. And
when can I get my hands on it?
You can get your hands for it. You can go to Amazon.com and look at Created for Connection. And we're now doing it. The U.S. military have instructed all their chaplains to start using it and doing these groups with their men. Huh. And we're amazingly proud of it. And I think the nuns who educated me would actually get a big chuckle out of the fact that I wrote a book.
I was just going to ask that. The nuns must be proud. Wow.
Yeah, well, because I was a difficult student, you know.
No.
I kept asking really difficult questions about things like, why was the Pope infallible? I didn't believe it.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, so I wasn't easy. So they'd have a real yuck about the fact that Sue Johnson has written a book called Created for Connection. But we're proud of it, and it's reaching the Christian community all over the world.
Absolutely incredible. This last hour has been a highlight for the year for me. Thank you.
Oh, aren't you sweet?
I am sweet. But aside from that, Dr. Sue Johnson is who we've been chatting with. DrSueJohnson.com. Of course, Love Sense, Hold Me Tight and all. I mean, listen, go to the site and find one of these seminars or groups or I don't know, whatever the heck you guys are doing, building community and helping people see behind the curtain of fractured relationships. It is just amazing stuff. And I'm proud that you are one of ours. I'm proud. I mean, I know you got that weird accent, but you're Canadian pretty much, right? So.
Yes, I'm absolutely Canadian. Yeah. I came here at 22, and I'm totally Canadian. Canada's the best. I travel all over the world.
Yeah.
And I'm always proud to be a Canadian.
Thank you. Sue, thank you so much.
You're most welcome. It was incredible fun to talk to you anytime.
Good stuff. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Sue.